The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today, Sean Hazlett interviews Sharon Lee on A Leiden Universe Constellation, Volume 6, Part 2, and we bring you more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 64.
I come from Baltimore, and the neighbor of the block was a very important social unit. So he's teaching the block baker how to do things and how to actually interpret the recipe she got from her great-great-grandma, who does make no sense anymore. So as he's doing that, he's waiting for the rest of his people, the adults, to come in from where they had gone during this disturbance, and all of them come back except one. Mm-hmm. And it's a Hallmark movie, so it has a happy ending. But the Mercs, the neighborhood they extracted these people from on Liad, is called Loport. And again, the block is a very important social structure. And these people have for years been a centerpiece to this block of people. The bakery was the core of their society, and the school was in the bakery, and they taught people in Loport who were very poor and needing to think about survival before they think about niceties like being able to read. Taught them to read, taught them that helping your neighbor is better than stabbing your neighbor, taught them to, you know, stand up and be proud next to each other. And then they've been pulled out. The baker's gone. What are the neighbors going to do? And in Our Lady of Benevolence, you thought I forgot, didn't you? In Our Lady of Benevolence, what has happened is that the instability in Loport and the vacuum created by the lack of the people in the bakery has pulled in another boss. She's going to take over the street. And what we wanted to find out is where the neighbors were going to stand. If the neighbors were going to backslide or go forward. Because the person who comes in to fill this vacuum is an old style Loport boss, guns first, reason later. Mm-hmm. And are they going to actually be able to keep what they've learned and to improve on it? And so that was a very interesting exercise. How do we do it now? For an experiment.
So you mentioned you were from Baltimore, so clearly, or it seems, that you pulled a lot from that experience, at least regarding the block concept. Was there anything else regarding change in kind of the external world, things are going on today, or anything like that, that were also embodied in that story?
Well, as much as we don't like to, writers live in the world. And you make a decision almost every day. Do you go forward or do you go back? Or do you stay in one place? Staying in one place is actually not viable. You can't, because things are moving around you. And if you don't move forward or backwards, something's going to push you or grab you. So it's better to make your own choice. So the story is about going, or about making a choice. And in Baltimore, there were good streets and bad streets. I'm sure there are other cities that have this. There were, the street where I grew up, which was a good street, and the street two blocks over, you didn't go there. And that's just paying attention to your world. I don't know if I answered that question or not.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about Baltimore, it's probably changed significantly.
Oh, my goodness. Versus,
I mean, I hate to ask you this, but I'm going to ask you this. Have you ever seen that HBO series, The Wire?
No, you asked me that before. No, I haven't gotten to it yet.
You gotta see it. You absolutely have to see it.
I will. Here we go.
Yeah, but I mean, how would you, again, while we're on this thread, I don't want to linger too long, but what's your, have you been back at all to where you grew up since?
Yes, yeah, I've been back a couple of times, and I grew up in Baltimore, and I survived Baltimore. I don't want to go back to Baltimore because, you know, I'm not that tough anymore. I'm different tough. I'm Maine tough now.
yeah.
And I don't know the good streets from the bad streets.
Yeah, they're probably mostly all bad at this point.
Mm. Well, that's a shame.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just interesting in the story.
I remember walking down Redwood Street because I worked at the University of Maryland downtown as a school of social work for years, and I lived up on Eager Street, so I just walked to work. I gather that nowadays it's not really a good thing to walk from Eager Street to the University of Maryland.
Yeah, watch The Wire. You will see some crazy stuff and why it's, you know, it's not necessarily, it's not a documentary, but it's based on kind of things that, some things that happened in that city.
The Wire, is that newspaper?
No, it's an HBO series.
Today, there'll be light rain with a forecast of high 46.
Is that Siri answered you?
The mic's off.
You bet it. I'm going to know that it's raining.
Yeah. So it's an HBO series. It's, I think there's like four seasons, and each season focuses on a specific area of Baltimore life. So I think there's one that's based on kind of the government. There's one based on the media, and there's, you know, two based on other things. I think one's based on the ports. So it just goes through.
You can't tell a story about Baltimore without the port.
Exactly. But it is absolutely fascinating. It's one of the best kind of series. And they get it down to the accent too. Because I grew up in Delaware, and the accent there is very similar to like what a Baltimore accent is. And it's just, it's uncanny how like. Anyway, we're here to talk about your collection. That just inspired a whole different thing. Okay. Who decided what order to put the stories in? Was it you and, okay. And how did you think about that process? We already talked about the first story, and I think that was a brilliant choice to put that first. But what other considerations did you have when you put it together?
Well, I do have in my back pocket, I did put together an anthology at one point. And at that point, my idea was to do a heavy story, a light story, a heavy story, a light story, to give people a breather, and not have too many heavy stories together so that you don't want to pick it up because it's all too dark. This one, I seem to have made different choices because Standing Orders, though that's sort of an upper, and then Gadriel's Folly. And then The Last Train to Clarksville. Okay, yeah, I did try with what I had to follow that pattern to give people a breathing spell. I just started out with a lighter story rather than a heavier one. You want people to come back to the stories, and even though some people don't read them in order, you don't want to create a feeling of unremitting gloom and darkness.
So. Right. Now, there was something at the beginning of that particular story about the angel Gadriel. Like you were quoting something.
What was that again? Gadriel. The Angel Gabriel is one of, I have another book around here someplace called The Dictionary of Angels and Fallen Angels from Gustav. Did I manage to say that?
I think you quoted some source. I just can't remember what the source was.
Yes, but it was Gustav actually Davidson, Free Press, 1971. Gabriel is one of the many, many gods and or angels who is credited with bringing the arts of war to men.
Mm.
So that's why Gabriel is falling.
And Gadriel's a fallen angel, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I figured as much. Okay. Anyway, I didn't mean to take you off from the.
No, that's okay. And I like, you know, I also was raised Catholic, so I like having nuns in various situations where you wouldn't necessarily find a nun doing her work. So.
Yeah, I mean, what, Baltimore was a Catholic city, right? It was founded by Lord Baltimore.
It was a Catholic city.
Okay. Now, what are you kind of looking for? Or I'm assuming you have a stable of short stories that have been published elsewhere, but have not been published in a Leiden Universe anthology. Is there kind of a seven on the way at some point? Like, are there enough stories for that yet?
No, I think I cleaned myself out on six. I haven't written a short story in a while. There are, what I'm doing right now is getting two novels ready to reissue. The rights came back to us, so I'm getting ready to reissue them rather than writing short stories.
Are you going to reissue them through Bain, or are you going to like self
reissue? Well, they're going to be self-published. Bain gave us the rights back.
Okay.
So they're two dark fantasies, Dunfray and Long Eye, and I'm going to be republishing them myself, or through Pinbeam Books, which is the Lee and Miller publishing empire.
And what's that process like? I mean, this is an opportunity to sell those as well. No, it is.
Yes. Well, the problem is, and I've been talking about this on Facebook, these two books were written. They were meant to be written under a pseudonym so that we would do the writer thing of having a main line, the Leiden, Charlene, Steve Miller line, and then we would have the pseudonym to kind of, you know, even out the cash flow. However, life got complicated. What a surprise. And our long-term publisher at that point, Misha Merlin, went out of business, owing us some money. And we asked our agent to, and we didn't know if we were going to get the rights out. He went messily out of business. We didn't know if the Leiden Universe was now going to get tangled up in a bankruptcy problem. So the only thing our agent had to sell were these two dark fantasies, which were going to be under a pseudonym. And she pitched them to Tony. And Tony said, yes, I'll take them, but only if they go under Sharon Lee and Steve Miller. And they were so different from anything we had written in the Leiden Universe that people rejected them. And I just now read them, and the pushback from those novels was terrible. I almost quit writing because of it.
Why was there pushback? Is because you just had a dedicated fan base, and it was things that they weren't used to reading, or was the rationale? In your opinion?
In my opinion, I had people tell me, no, these are dark fantasies. They are very dark fantasies. I had one lady tell me that she had thrown away all her Leiden books after reading these books. That I had betrayed her so badly. and I got letters from people yelling about that. And this character, as I found out, just rereading these books after 20 years, I went in thinking, okay, this is going to be really kind of bad because these are bad books. They're terrific.
Yeah, it sounds like it's just a mismatch with the audience.
It did not find its audience, and that's the problem. Space opera is not dark fantasy, right. Which is why different name. But they're great books. I am surprised. Yeah. So I'm really pleased to be bringing them back out. I think this time, if they can find their audience, they'll be better received. But at the point where we put them out under our name, I went to Steve and I said, I'm going to quit. I'm quitting. I'm not going to write anymore. And he said, why? He said, because people are writing to me. This is back when the internet was still relatively young. People were writing to me and telling me how terrible these books are and how awful, how could I have thought of these things? And they're bad books. And he said, you know, well, okay, let's go first. Are they bad books? Did you cheat and write bad books? And I said, no, you know how hard they were to write, but I did my best by them. I was lead on these for mm-hmm. other reasons. And he said, okay, so don't read the mail. Easy. I said, but we always, always, always answer our reader's mail. And he said, okay, fine. Send them to me and I'll deal with them. And so that's what we did. And a couple of days later, he said, you're still thinking about cheating and you're still thinking about quitting. And I said, I don't know why. He said, well, I need a short story for the SRM Yule chapbook. You know, I'm going to get this. I'm going to write the one. But if I can get a story from you, you know, that would be great. So I sat down and wrote a short story and, you know, end of conversation. but it was a near thing. It was, and they had convinced me that that my books were unworthy. And that was a sad thing. They were not. They were great books. The world is marvelous.
As you're preparing to put them out, what are they about, like high level?
They're about a the first the Fae fought a war, and the war was so terrible that they used their powers to create this thing called a Kaylee that basically cut the world in half. And they were safe on this half of the Kaylee, and whatever happened on the other half happened. And the other half became colonized after a while by humans. And humans have these wonderful, beautiful auras that Fae find irresistible. They become addicted to the humans' auras. And the story is about a guy who decides, a Fae who decides that the queen is not doing a good enough, the Fae queen is not doing a good enough job, and he is going to collect Kest, magical power, from mm-hmm. all of his enemies and use it to depose the queen. And his tool for doing this is a human woman who he imports from across the Kaylee. And it's a dark story. It's a story of subjugation and people making really bad choices and people hurting other people, but finally realizing their choice is available and beginning to choose for themselves and for the world, which is falling apart because these terrible forces that create the Kaylee are just ripping the world apart. And the healing needs to happen on a world level as much as on a personal level. Honestly, really good.
Well, I mean, it's dark fantasy. Like, that's like straight down the middle dark fantasy. That's the way it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So, it's completely different than the Liaden universe, which absolutely. I suspect is absolutely. Why you know, people were expecting
anti-Liaden books.
They were expecting Liaden universe books. Like, that's not anything. It's not going to be anything like any dark fantasy, of course.
And we told people as loud as we could, these are not Liaden books. These are dark, but.
And when are these books going to be released or re-released? Well,
I'm working on them now. It depends on how good I am this time about compiling the books and getting them together. I'm formatting them right now. So.
Okay, and then in terms of what sort of, I mean, that's obviously one of the projects that you're working on. You're working on, I think, two novels you're putting out. Are there any other projects that you want to make your fans aware of?
Well, people do seem confused. There are two more books under contract with Bing, and they are Leiden books. Kinwright just was turned in, and I'm having a little bit of vacation, and in June I'm going to start the next book.
So, you hear that, Tony? She's working on it. She's working on it, okay?
I'm working.
Give her a break. All right. I'm just kidding.
And, other than that, I'm doing Stained Glass on the side. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah. I think we talked about that in the last interview, right?
We talked about that the last time. And I have a shirt that has stars on it. A fan gave it to me with the titles of the books that have been published to that point. But that only went through Dragon in Exile. So I have 18 stars that I have to embroider titles on to put on the shirt. So that'll take me a minute or two.
Yeah, lots of things to keep you busy, which is great. Mm-hmm. So are you reading any books? I mean, you said you're rereading a lot of your own books, but are there any other books that you've been reading or have read in the last 6 months or so that you would recommend? Well, that you think are particularly interesting?
Well, I'm reading a book right now. I've just started it. It's called Falling Forward. Actually, it comes into some of the topics we were covering today. And it's about the science of resilience. Mm. Why some people, two people will walk through the exact same trauma and one will break and one will go, okay, I can do this. And why is that? That's an interesting question for many reasons. Other than that, I have been mostly reading the Leiden books. There are 28 of them, and that's a project all by itself. So far, I haven't been disappointed, mm-hmm. which is always
probably good. Pleasantly surprised. You're like, did I write that?
In some of them, yes. I talked to you about that. The Crystal books. Especially have been a surprise to me. So I'm having fun with that. And I'm following my own advice. I'm reading heavy for a while, and then I'm reading things like Sick in Persephone, which is a Regency romance. And just taking breathers in between chunks of books.
And any movies or... you haven't watched The Wire yet, which you need to put on there.
I'm not much with movies. I watched The Apothecary Diaries, which was very good. Good on Crunchyroll. And it's about a chemist, a pharmacist in ancient China who is, for reasons, who goes into the Imperial City and becomes a detective based on her knowledge of plants and people and how things react. And that was very well done. You might mm-hmm. really like that. And I also just nope, it's going to go away. I basically, what I do is I flip through and I go, oh, that sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. And if it is, I'll watch. And if it's not, then I just turn it off. Mostly, though, I reach for a book.
All right. Any final words for the audience?
Thank you, audience, for listening. Thank you for your patience.
And I believe this book comes out on May 5th, Cinco de Mayo.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now.
So, and you can, by the way, pre-order it now if you can. Yes. You can get it on Amazon or your favorite bookstore. Just ask. In fact, it's probably better if they just, well, I don't know if it's better, but if you go to your local bookstore and ask for it to make sure that they stock it, that
You don't want to be behind everybody rushing off to read this book.
Exactly. So definitely go out and get it and check out, you know, the books that you're going to have coming out under your own imprint as well once they do. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Sharon. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I can't wait to see how this thing progresses.
Okay, thank you so much.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Makin, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
As you might imagine, I said, I have a lot of questions. Let's start with the obvious ones. How long has it been since you dropped me off outside Queen's Bar? What happened to me? And where are we?
About 70 hours, the last 14 and a half of which you've spent sleeping. Lobo said, you were kidnapped and interrogated by some Kelco staff, and we retrieved you. We're in orbit around Velna.
Lovely. Anytime I want a simple answer from Lobo, I can't shut him up. When I'd appreciate some details, he turns into Mr. Terse. I made a mental note to ask him sometime if there was a way he could display the amount of emotive programming at play in his answers. Having a sarcasm meter would be quite handy for dealing with him.
Do you think you'd gotten here on your own? Lim said.
I knew there was no chance she'd go for the sarcasm meter, so I didn't bring it up. No. I smiled and shook my head. I was feeling better. As I believe I said before, thank you for rescuing me. I do appreciate it. I'm just trying to understand what happened.
Fair enough, Lim said.
I have, of course, recorded all the aspects of the mission that I could monitor, Lobo said, a note of pride evident in his voice, the added emotion suggesting that perhaps I had indeed read the earlier sarcasm correctly. So, if you're interested, you can view the logs of the rescue itself.
It all started when you were late for the pickup, Lim said.
They took turns explaining to me what had happened, Lim doing most of the talking, Lobo speaking occasionally and providing the video log he'd mentioned. The story that emerged made me very glad I was working with them, sarcasm and all. After dropping me off, Lim consulted Chung about how he'd like us to return him. She stayed out of his sight and used a voice scrambler so her identity remained unknown to him. He was understandably angry, but he relaxed a lot when Lim finally convinced him that I hadn't intentionally put Jasmine in jeopardy and that he was going to walk away from this. After some negotiation, they agreed on a simple but safe plan. Lobo invested some time in basic evasive maneuvers outside the atmosphere, moving among a few heavily populated orbits with no particular goal. Chung agreed to be sedated and took a pill Lim provided through a hatch Lobo opened. When his monitors indicated Chung was in deep sleep, Lobo used his camo capabilities to once again blend with the cliff tourist shuttles and fly the coastline. He landed with a group of them in time for the mid-afternoon tour group switch. Lim had brought more than work gear with her. Dressed in a color-shifting pantsuit, a blonde wig falling loose around her face, huge sunglasses covering her eyes and most of her face, Lim looked every bit the trophy girl embarrassed at escorting her drunken husband off the shuttle and to the nearest restroom. She'd given Chung a mild stimulant to bring him up to a fuzzy consciousness. So he leaned on her and lurched along, but would remember nothing. When Zycheck security followed up, everyone who'd seen her would remember her,
and the cameras would have captured a lot of good images, but neither the people nor the photos would provide a useful trail back to her. So many people passed through the station that her DNA trail wouldn't matter either. She left Chung at the restroom door and got in line to board another shuttle. At the last minute, she appeared to change her mind and walked quickly down the strip to a different shuttle, one that happened to be Lobo. Once they were airborne, Lim called one of her team members who was on holiday in Lankin. He used an anonymous connection at a comm joint in Queen's Bar to send Chung's location to Zychek security. Lim and Lobo, trusting the quality of Zychek's team, hadn't followed up on Chung. But the worst case, they felt, was that Chung awoke in the restroom, robbed and sick. No one at a tourist shuttle site was likely to bother to kill him when they could have his wallet for nothing. Lobo landed a few minutes before sunset, correctly planning to minimize his time on the ground. At precisely sunset, he started monitoring the frequency of my transmitter to see how long they'd have to wait for me. When 3 minutes had passed without him detecting a transmission, Lobo knew something was wrong and told Lim. On the chance that I'd been coerced into revealing our pickup plans and to generally minimize risk, Lobo immediately took off and blended in with the last of the tourist shuttle crowd. From there, he started the search. They swept along the coastline up to the northernmost corporate headquarters, but with no luck. Lobo flew a slow series of parallels up and down the continent, starting with the area over the city until he was about a quarter of the planet away. When he still hadn't detected even a trace of a signal, he headed up to the highest orbital plane on which he could find recent signs of ship or satellite activity. He plotted a cylinder with its center over Beckens Deal and a radius equal to the peak range of the transmitter and started sweeping it for a signal. The search was maddening, Lim said, a blind trawling exercise that over the course of many hours reminded her just how much empty space exists around every planet. After moving down one radius of the cylinder to a lower orbital plane and shifting a radius westward of the city, Lobo picked up my signal. He traced it to a small gray, logo-free satellite floating unobtrusively among a group of FC weather sats and Kelco comm relays. At this point, I'd been missing over 28 hours. Per our previous agreement, Lim took command. First priority was intel. Aside from the occasional short bursts from my transmitter, the sat was electromagnetically inert. Nothing about it read as military, and it sported no obvious signs of armor. Lobo and Lim monitored it for almost an hour before it engaged in a short, bidirectional comm link with a source on Lankin. Lobo traced the link back to Kelco headquarters there, so now they knew they had to hit fast and hard, or Kelco would launch serious corporate security in pursuit. With no more data available, Lim opted for as much of a crash-and-trash approach as was feasible, given that I was aboard. Lobo copied the markings of one of the FC weather sats and over the course of an hour moved slowly into a position with a clean line of sight to the target. During that time, the sat didn't communicate with Kelco on the ground. When the next communication began, Lobo moved a bit closer, and Lim suited up. Right after the sat broke contact with Kelco Corporate on the assumption that no one on the ground would be likely to contact it again for a while, Lim gave the go. Lobo fired an EM disruptor missile. It moved in fast, hit the sat, and sent a pulse through the vessel. If the structure was mil-spec and armored, the disruptor would fail. But they had to bank that the small satellite wasn't up to those standards. Lobo followed the missile in and docked hard with the sat, broadcasting interference waves to block as much as possible any communication with the ground. Lobo opened his airlock, and Lim stepped in. From that point on, they had multiple AV streams for me. The output of feeds from Lim's forward camera and mic, the in-helmet camera and mic focused on her face, and the body function monitors Lobo maintained on her. The sound from the forward mic, mixed with an undercurrent of Lim's initially steady breathing, filled the room from Lobo's speakers. The forward camera's output, the images of the camera on Lim and the standard personnel vitals played across Lobo's wall displays. Darkness bathed the SAT's interior, the only lighting a soft green glow from the emergency strips. Lim plugged a lead from Lobo into the airlock's manual override port and waited while Lobo hacked the switch, impatience showing in her elevated heartbeat and her gloved left fist occasionally smacking the wall. The SAT was definitely not mil-spec. Anything modern and military would have launched virus attacks against Lobo and used stronger encryption than his processors could defeat in any reasonable period of time. At just under 2 minutes into the mission, the door indicator glowed ready. Lim pushed it open, staying behind Lobo's wall as she did. A shower of projectiles hit Lobo's inner airlock wall. Lobo flashed to Lim's heads-up display the data from a forward video feed. An unarmored guard stood across from the airlock, bending around the corner carefully, exposing only part of his head, his hands, and the projectile rifle he held. Lim ordered Lobo to take him out, not trank him. Lobo fired an energy beam mounted beside the camera. Lim watched in her heads-up display as the exposed portion of the guard's head turned into a fine mist. She smiled and said, "Good work." Lim ran in and flattened herself against the wall the guard had been peering around. Two halls led away from her position, one toward the guard and the other into blackness on the opposite side. She tossed a sensor grenade down the hall with the guard, then threw another down the other hall. The grenades sprayed microsensors as they first flew through the air and then fell and rolled along the floor. No weapons hit them. So, with a lack of armor on the vessel, Lim decided to risk that it was pure civilian issue and unlikely to have any significant automated defense systems. Lobo collated the IR and temperature feeds from each hallway's sensors and fed the results to two new images in Lim's display. Both halls were empty, so Lim backtracked the guard and headed down his passageway.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Tune in next week as Jeremy Comeau sits down to interview David West and DJ Butler on their collaborative novel, Hell on Wheels, Part 1. We'll have further One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name as we close in on the finale in Part 65. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.